Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there from New York. How are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got an interview with Neha Narula from MIT's Digital Currency Initiative, where we discuss Bitcoin security and ethics. But before that, I've got a message from my show sponsors. So firstly, today's show is brought to you by Dropbit, without doubt the best mobile Bitcoin wallet in the whole world, and the only wallet I'm using. I actually use it quite regularly now when I travel, rather than travel around with my hardware wallets. I just load up a few sats on my Dropbit wallet, and if I need Bitcoin, I've got Bitcoin. And like when they told me when we first met that they're like a Venmo for Bitcoin, they really are. It is the easiest way to send and receive Bitcoin, and they've smashed the UX. I also absolutely love their new feature where you can tweet Bitcoin to people. And I know a lot of you have actually downloaded the app since I've been working with them, which is cool. Nothing but great feedback. But if you haven't, why haven't you checked it out? Come on, go and download Dropbit. Go and check it out. I might even send you some Bitcoin. It's available for the iPhone and Android. Just head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. That's dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. And today's show is also brought to you by my buddies over at Accounting, the best tax calculator in the market. And I know what you're thinking. Yeah, Pete, you just say this because they're a sponsor. Nope. I actually went and checked out all their competitors and they're all rubbish. Accounting is definitely the best tax calculator in the market. So if you're taking your tax seriously, you've got to check out Accounting. Not only is it the best tax calculator, but it's got a badass portfolio management solution too, which allows you to optimize your trades to reduce your tax burden. And not only is it the best tax calculator, it is the best price tax calculator in the market, and you only pay at the point you want your tax report. The UX is great. You can import your data from all major exchanges and wallet providers. So if you're going to take your tax seriously, go and check out Accounting. It's available at accounting.com, which is accounting.com. That is accounting.com, which is accounting.com. Okay, so on to my interview with Neha, which was recorded a couple of weeks ago when I was out in Boston after I did the Taj interview. Neha is the director at MIT's Digital Currency Initiative, and I was also lucky enough to be her table buddy at the Coin Center dinner. Got to spend some time with her, told her I wanted to do an interview, so we booked it in. And we started off by discussing how the Bitcoin Foundation collapsing led to the Digital Currency Initiative, and what the project's goals and incentives are, and it kind of fell into a conversation around Bitcoin security. Neha explained the issues with discovering a bug and needing legal support just to disclose the bug to developers. So it was really an unusual thing that I wasn't prepared for. I didn't even know about, or I hadn't even considered. We also discussed 51% attacks, anonymous bank robbers, and whether proof of work is the best solution for Bitcoin. And don't worry, Neha does still think that proof of work is better than proof of stake. But we also covered vulnerabilities that may be in the protocol right now and even got into the ethics of Bitcoin. It was a super interesting interview. Love doing it. I hope you enjoy it. You know, if you've got any feedback, you can get back to me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Would love to hear from you. Also, just a note, I want to talk to you about the Wyoming blockchain events which are coming up, which I've been invited to by Caitlin Long in September. If you know Caitlin, you know she's been doing a whole bunch of stuff out in Wyoming to support the industry. She also confirmed to me Wyoming does exist. It is real. And out in Wyoming, they won't tax your crypto. And they've enacted a solution to the problem for the on and off ramps between fiat and crypto, which will come online in 2020. Crypto startups are migrating there. And even my show sponsor, Kraken, have been out there. So I'm heading out to Wyoming in September to the Wyoming Blockchain Stampede, which includes a WIO Hackathon, a conference for both developers and businesses, and the North American Finals of the Sandcastle. Invitational registrations are open at wyohackathon.io, which is wyohackathon.io, so go check that out. Also, if you want to support the show, just head over to my website, whatbitcoindid.com, click on the support section. And I also need to say a massive thanks to my Patreon top tier sponsor, VidGen, makers of vidhash.com, where demonetized YouTube content creators can earn Monero, which you can then sell and get more Bitcoin when fans watch via their web mining links. Check that out at vidhash.com, which is vidhash.com. Okay, on to the interview. If you've got any questions, you can reach out to me. You know my email address, but it's hello@whatbitcoindid.com.
Do you live in London?
Just outside.
Bedford. Okay, Bedford, got it.
You ever been to Bedford?
I don't think so, no.
Nobody has.
But you know, everybody complaining about property prices in London. I've heard definitely heard a lot of that.
Well, yeah, it's unaffordable for most people. Mm-hmm. Bedford's actually really benefited from it because it's 35 minutes on the train.
Yeah.
A lot of money's come into the town, and over the last kind of 5 years, it's changed a lot. But I want to live over here.
You
want to
live here?
Well, not in Boston. I mean, Boston's okay.
Yeah.
But I'd like to live in America.
Like in San Francisco? New York?
Probably L.A.
L.A.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got it.
Yeah, Boston's like the opposite of L.A.
Yeah, but I like Boston. I kind of feel at home here when both times I've been
there. It's a little bit European. Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite British from feeling. Yeah. And the hotel I'm staying at's really cool. Do you
Which
know
one?
The Verb?
No,
it's
I don't
right
know.
Right by Fenway.
Oh, nice. That's fun. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but annoyingly, the Sox aren't playing while I'm here.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
It's really fun to go to a game.
I'd love to go. I've been to the baseball in L.A., and it's great. I loved
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Oh, but Fenway's a whole different experience.
I know.
Like the locals and Bostonians and, oh, it's
they
really,
go crazy.
Really fun. Yeah, yeah. I'm not really a baseball person, but even, you know, it's an experience. Like, yeah, got to check it out.
So I really enjoyed the expo.
Oh, that's awesome. That's right. You were here for the MIT Bitcoin Expo. And who did you interview when you were here then?
I interviewed Andrew Polstra,
right?
Christian Decker,
okay,
and Jack Mallers.
Okay, got
it. That was cool. But the conference was really cool. What a great speaker lineup you got.
Yeah, it's great because the expo, I think, was started in 2014, I want to say. And MIT was really one of the first universities who like actually got interested in Bitcoin. And I think, therefore, the expo, it's been around quite a while and has a reputation and people show up for it, which is great.
Is it Hugo?
Mm-hmm.
Hugo looked after me.
Yeah.
Hugo is great. I should have told him I was here. I totally forgot about it.
You should have come a couple days earlier. We had our first BitDevs meeting on Tuesday.
Nick Carter told me.
Yeah.
Was it good?
It was surprisingly very good. It was the first one. We didn't really know how it was going to go, but it was really good. There were 75 people.
Wow.
Which for Boston is kind of surprising. And it was great. It was exactly what I wanted, which was going over all of the latest with what's going on with Bitcoin, like in some detail.
Amazing. And how long have you been here at MIT?
Oh gosh, I've been at MIT like 10 years now, but I was doing my PhD here. So I moved here in 08, 09 to do my PhD.
And
I have not left.
What was your PhD?
Computer science.
You did a computer, so you went from computer science degree to 60 Minutes superstar.
Yeah, sure. If 2 minutes on 60 Minutes counts as a superstar, sure. Yeah.
So I'm tracking you all down. That's why I'm going to see Charlie afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got to go to Laszlo. He's great.
Well, yeah.
He's also in Florida.
Did he do the first Lightning pizza as well?
He might have, yeah. I think that might have been him. Yes, yeah. I think they found him. He's interested in Lightning too, so yeah.
So at what point did you start becoming interested in... I'm going to stick with Bitcoin rather than... I know you're neutral here, but when was the transition into that and the creation of... Were you here at the start when they first created the DCI?
No, I was not, actually. So I was finishing my PhD, and I did not do anything cryptocurrency related during my PhD. Obviously, new Bitcoin existed. I think I had bought a Bitcoin or two or something like that. I had some very good friends who were quite obsessed with it, Vijay Boyapati and Ben Davenport. So they talked about...
You know Vijay?
Yes. Yeah.
Vijay's great.
We worked at Google together.
Oh,
so,
did you?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And so they talked about Bitcoin nonstop and were quite obsessed with it. And I remember hanging out with them in 2011 in Seattle and just being like, these guys are crazy. So I pretty much ignored it. I think someone in my lab might have been secretly mining Litecoin on a computer even. But I was working in distributed systems for my PhD. And it wasn't until I graduated and I actually stepped back and spent some time trying to think about what I wanted to do next. And got a chance to really take a look at Bitcoin and actually figure out how it worked. And I think, then what happened was I went down the proverbial rabbit hole immediately. And I was just fascinated by it as a technology. And during my PhD, I'd never actually taken the time to really understand how it works. Like, you kind of have a rough idea, right? You're like, okay, chain of blocks, transactions, minting Bitcoin, transferring them around. But when you really figure out how it works and why it might actually work, I think it was like a breakthrough. So that's what really got me interested. So that summer, yeah.
And so what was your first role then?
Well,
did you go straight to director?
Sort of. So it was really funny, actually. So the DCI, I think in large part, was started by this undergrad named Jeremy Rubin. And Jeremy also started the MIT Bitcoin Club, the MIT Bitcoin Expo, and organized what's called the MIT Drop, the Bitcoin Drop, which is when every undergraduate got $100 worth of Bitcoin.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So he was a very precocious undergrad. And, you know, I really credit him. He's the one who told me about the DCI and introduced me to Joey Ito, who's the director of the Media Lab. And so from then, I sort of informally got involved with the DCI and sort of strengthened those formal relations. And then when the first director left, I took over.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so as director, what's your remit?
What's my remit? That's a great question. So we're part of the MIT Media Lab, right? The Media Lab is a lab at MIT, and there's lots of other labs at MIT too. But the thing you have to understand, sometimes people expect MIT to operate as a sort of single controlled organization, and that is just absolutely not true. There's a lot of people here who are doing a lot of different things, and you might even find that there are people doing the same thing who don't even know about each other. So that happens a lot. The Media Lab in particular is kind of this crazy place where there are people who write operas, there are people who do brain surgery on mice, there are people who do art exhibitions, people who study the ethics of self-driving cars. It's really quite a mix of different types of things. And usually what you find is that the types of things people are working on, they span multiple disciplines, or they don't quite fit cleanly into any single box. And so I think cryptocurrency fits that perfectly. But the thing is that the Media Lab is chaos. And so I think really what's great about being in a position like this is that you kind of get to make of it what you want. So when the DCI was started, it really, in part, came out of the demise of the Bitcoin Foundation. So there were these... So the Bitcoin Foundation went through a lot of upheaval in late 2014, early 2015. And there were these three engineers who work on Bitcoin full-time who were, you know, jobless with the destruction of the Bitcoin Foundation. And so through some negotiation, they ended up getting hired at the Media Lab, and the DCI was kind of formed around them. So that is, we still employ two of those Bitcoin engineers, Vladimir Vanderlaan and Corey Fields. And so that is definitely an important part of what we do, is we serve as what I call one of the pillars of Bitcoin development. So we're a neutral, nonprofit university that is employing people to just work on the Bitcoin open source protocol in whatever way they see fit to do so.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So it is really cool. And it's awesome because it connects us, I think, to, you know, pretty cutting edge development. And it's just great. So that's one thing we do, which is a little bit unusual for an academic group at a university. And so another component of what we do is we work on research. So I did my PhD here. I wrote research papers. We continue to write research papers. The way to describe it is we're working on, you know, sort of like cryptocurrency is just not ready for a billion users. It's nowhere. It's not ready for that level for many, many different reasons. Like, we still have a lot of really fundamental problems to solve.
Look, I've got it written there. Bitcoin is not ready for a billion of users.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's my line.
That's your line. I took that from you.
That's my line.
Yeah.
Which is okay. I mean, that's what makes this exciting, and that's why I want to work on it. I think if all of the problems were solved, this would be really, really boring.
Yeah.
But there are so many problems that we have to figure out. And some of them, I think, are things that people take for granted. Like, oh yeah, Lightning's going to scale Bitcoin. It's going to be great. It's going to work perfectly. It's like, oh gosh, do you realize how complex this is and how many things? Like, I'm super excited about it. I think the progress that the different groups working on Lightning have made is outstanding. It's incredible. Super excited. Still a lot to figure out.
as you've
talked about on this show. And then other things like the security. People take proof of work for granted. There's this assumption that, you know, hash power and proof of work, it's very expensive to undo it's infeasible to think about rewriting the Bitcoin blockchain. And I don't think people have really delved into that question enough and really unpacked, like, what kind of security are we getting from proof of work? Like, what really are the incentives going on in the ecosystem as a whole, like, not just with the miners? And, you know, are there things we can do to make it more secure? Like, is it, you know, are we getting the security we think we're getting from it? It's important to ask these types of questions, especially as I think people who are very excited about Bitcoin and really positive about it and, like, really believe in the technology and think it's groundbreaking, you know, not necessarily as people who just want to say, proof of work, it wastes energy, you know, but people who actually really are interested but want to understand what we're getting out of it.
So how do you decide what to work on then? How do you prioritize?
Yeah, so we are 10 people total, and we get together and we talk about it, and we talk a lot. We talk about everything that's going on. I think one thing that's really important is that we are here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We are not in Silicon Valley. We are not in New York. And so we have some distance from
The noise.
Yeah, the tech chatter, the finance chatter, the investment chatter. Like, we're pretty removed from that. A lot of people on my team, I think, are pretty anti-capitalist, to be quite frank. So it's a little bit of a different area. Like, you know, I'm reminded of so Paul Graham, who started Y Combinator, you know, used to write a lot of essays, and one of these essays he wrote was about cities and what cities say, right? And when you walk around a city, like, what kind of message are you getting? What are the values that are coming out of that city? And, you know, New York is about money and power. LA is about power, but a different kind of power, right? Like, it's more, it's like entertainment power. It's like, you know, social power. And San Francisco is about living well. That was the way he sort of described it, making an impact on the world. Cambridge is very intellectual. It's about knowledge. You walk around and everyone's like a postdoc or a grad student, and they're studying some like arcane part of history. And they, you know, people aren't here to just to make a bunch of money. People aren't here to try to impose their will on the world. The people are here to try to understand and create. And so I think being in that environment, having people in that environment think about cryptocurrency is really important. I think, you know, it's an important role we serve, that we're not here to make just to make a bunch of money. We're here to, like, because we actually really like the technology and want to understand it. So, long way of answering your question, how do we choose what to work on? We decide, which is pretty great. And I think everything we do is driven from this desire to, we have like these values posted on our website. We want to figure out how to build this technology for the public good. So that's really, really important. Things like financial inclusion, user empowerment, user control, open access, things like that, sort of privacy, all of these things sort of influence what we work on.
Okay. But you are also neutral. You're not a Bitcoin group, but you have a heavy focus on Bitcoin. But.
Yeah. So part of our origin story is we came out of the demise of the Bitcoin Foundation. Yeah. And the DCI was started in, I think, officially April 2015. So Ethereum, I don't think, had launched yet, right? Like, you know, there wasn't really another dominant cryptocurrency. Yeah. So we launched in that environment. We were always open to potentially supporting developers from other cryptocurrencies. I think that what ended up happening was that the token sale model took off, and a lot of other cryptocurrencies or other alternative funding models, a lot of other cryptocurrencies have foundations, they have
money.
Yeah, they have a lot of money to fund development, right? They have these pools of money to fund development. Bitcoin does not have a pool of money to fund development. And a lot of people work on it anyway. And there are a lot of very wealthy people in Bitcoin who fund development out of the whatever, the goodness of their hearts, or because they realize it will make their Bitcoin worth more. And I think, you know, the people who don't do that aren't very smart, to be quite frank. I don't think they're really doing what they should be doing for their investment. But yeah, Bitcoin doesn't have that. And so, and also, it's just that, yeah, so there, so part of it is need, right? Like, where's the need? And I think there's a need in the Bitcoin ecosystem for what we do. It's really important. Another part of it is, yeah, we're not biased or pro one coin, or, you know, everybody at the DCI has different opinions, to be quite frank. Like, some people probably are maximalists and some people aren't maximalists and believe in other things, and that's totally fine. But I think what underlies everything is looking for technical credibility and rigor. So where is the technical credibility? Where do we have people who are actually running things in production at scale that really work, who are really thinking through the security, you know, who are working on things that really have a lot of underlying depth to them. And that's what we focus on.
Which kind of takes you back to Bitcoin mainly anyway. Mm-hmm. I watched your presentation from the Bitcoin Expo this morning, because I hadn't seen it before because I missed your talk. And I like the way how you said, because I just obviously met with Taj, that he can't just say no to everything.
Yeah.
You can't just say everything that sucks. But I thought it was a really interesting talk, actually. And I thought it'd be great to hear about the process you went through for the bug you found and the responsible disclosure side of things. Because what was really interesting to me is with disclosing a bug, all the different things that you had to think about that I didn't even realize you would have to think about. So can we go into this? Because I thought it was cool.
Yeah, what were you surprised by?
I mean, one of the things is that you had to have legal representation.
Right, right.
And I'm like, why would you have to have legal representation when you are finding a problem and telling people about it?
Yeah, yeah. So this is something that I was also not familiar with because I've never done a bug disclosure before. Mm. I'm not by background a security engineer. So this was very much new for me as well. And I was kind of like somewhat surprised, but then when you think about it, it makes sense. I was a little bit surprised to discover that there was this history of security researchers getting into basically being sued by giant companies or organizations or governments for disclosing bugs. It's kind of shocking when you think about it. Like,
totally.
Why would this happen? Don't you want people telling you if there's a problem in your software? But there's this history of, I guess, people trying to get security through obscurity. So they'd rather, you know, they think that it makes their software more secure if people don't know about it or don't know what's going on with it. And obviously, if you disclose a bug in something, it can affect reputation. And oftentimes people who write something are incentivized to not necessarily want to see the same things that someone who doesn't have those incentives might see. And that's, I think that's like the real core of the problem. And that's pretty prevalent in cryptocurrencies. And so what you end up with is you end up in these situations. So we were really lucky in that because a couple of the people that on our team were students at BU and MIT, we had access to the Boston University Legal Clinic. And shout out to that legal clinic because they did a bunch of free work for us, which was very nice of them. And maybe we were being paranoid, but I don't think so because we did receive some legal sort of, you know, legal threats on Twitter, whatever that's worth. So I'm really glad that we had that and we had them able to look at stuff. It's really scary. Like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is very broad and can be interpreted. I mean, basically, I was afraid to send a message to a server that I didn't control. That's kind of where we drew the line, was we're not going to send any messages, any network messages to any servers that, you know, we don't control and own. So it's kind of weird when you think about it, but you have to protect yourself, I think.
Yeah, it just wouldn't have crossed my mind. But then also another thing I guess wouldn't have crossed my mind is that you also have to be careful how you disclose it, because a bug in one cryptocurrency will likely appear in many, because many are just forks.
Yes.
And so if you disclose it to the wrong person, they might try and exploit that bug on another currency.
Yes, yes, yes. So this is something that I've been thinking about a lot over the past year, because it turns out that security and bug disclosure and vulnerability disclosure and deployment in cryptocurrencies is really tricky. And it's actually quite different than, you know, browser security or operating system security, because these are supposed to be systems where no one's in control, right?
Yep.
No one's supposed to be privileged. We're all supposed to be on the same ground. I'm running a node, you're running a node. Okay, some developers release some new software. I can look at it and decide whether I want to upgrade or not, but I don't have to. I can just keep running my node. And security and bugs and vulnerabilities kind of throw a wrench into everything. Because if you think about sort of the extremes, one extreme is you tell everybody at the same time about a bug, right? So, okay, there's this horrible bug in Bitcoin. We don't want to privilege anyone. So we're just, you know, an attacker could steal your money. So we're just going to tell everybody about it at the same time, right? And what's going to happen? A lot of users are not going to be paying attention. They're not going to upgrade their software. They're not going to know what's going on. A lot of businesses aren't going to be paying attention. And you're going to end up with a lot of people losing money, probably, if a bug like that gets out. Like, mm-hmm. That's called a zero day. That is a bad thing. Another extreme is that there's a privileged group of people who learn about it, and hopefully those people, instead of exploiting it, fix it and convince everyone to upgrade without them needing to know about it. And that's more like the situation that we're in right now, which is there's a security at email address for most cryptocurrencies, and that's where you report these vulnerabilities. But these things are, like, you can trade on them, you can attack, and we are seeing lots of attacks in the wild. So it's a pretty scary situation.
Next up, I talked to Neha more about Bitcoin security, but before that, I've got a message from my amazing sponsors. So first up, we've got Kraken, the best crypto exchange in the whole world. And it's the only place now I buy and sell Bitcoin. And tomorrow I'm flying out to Chicago. I'm off to interview Nick Pococo, Kraken's chief security officer. We're going to talk all things crypto security. It's an interview I've been trying to get in the diary for ages, especially since they launched Kraken Security Labs. Nick's an amazing guy, so I can't wait to get into that with him. Also, there's loads of stuff coming up at the end of this year from Kraken. They've been sharing some of it with me. It's very exciting. Can't wait to tell you about it all, so keep an eye out for that. But are you aware of everything Kraken does? You obviously know about the exchange. Are you using it? You should be, because they are definitely the best. I also mentioned Kraken Security Labs, where they look to improve security across the entire industry, but they've also got their OTC desk for large traders with private and personalized services. They've got Crypto Watch, where you can trade on multiple exchanges from a single platform. They also offer margin trading, futures, and indices. Look, if you're a trader, there's no one better to work with than Kraken. They have got your back covered. Come and join me in supporting Kraken. Head over to kraken.com, which is kraken.com. That is kraken.com, which is kraken.com. And next up, we've got the motherfucking BlockFi. I'm not really sure I can pull off that Joe Rogan style ad. Anyway, I love BlockFi, and I'm meeting up with Zach later and Jeremy from Casa. We're going to record a special show discussing Bitcoin utility, but we're also going to be getting into some privacy stuff. And it's pretty good timing because they've just announced a new partnership, which we're also going to discuss. Have you heard of this? You heard about BlockFi and Casa working together? Well, this partnership allows BlockFi clients to have access to both market-leading financial services and secure self-custody solution. Through the partnership, clients will be able to access Casa's multi-sig software for long-term savings and security. And it's so cool that two of my favorite companies in the space are working together. I love this. Through the partnership, BlockFi clients are eligible for $50 off the Casa node, which includes gold subscription. You can get $200 off your first year Casa Platinum with 3 or 5 KeyShield Multisig. You can get $500 off first year Casa Diamond with 3 or 5 KeyShield and full team support. And additionally, Casa members are eligible for reduced rates on BTC-backed loans at BlockFi, plus an additional 10% interest each month on BlockFi interest accounts at BlockFi's current rate of 6% annual interest. So that would mean Casa clients are eligible to earn 6.6% annual interest. Neither Casa nor BlockFi are earning profits directly from this partnership. Instead, they're just passing those on to their clients. This is so cool. You got to check it out. Head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. That's BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. These are things that I wouldn't normally have thought about. Can we unpack it? Can we go back to where this actually started? So what are the biggest security risks you think that exists within, say, Bitcoin? But obviously cryptocurrencies, but mine's a Bitcoin show. So what are the biggest risks here?
So that's a great question.
Do you know what I wrote underneath?
What?
Anonymous bank robbers.
Anonymous bank robbers. Yeah. Okay, yeah. What's the bank?
Well, I mean, I consider all of our Bitcoins as our bank accounts in some way.
I see.
So it's a decentralized bank.
Yeah, yeah. What are the risks to Bitcoin? Oh, God, there's so many risks.
the biggest ones.
Yeah, so I think if you talk to a lot of people, one thing that people are pretty worried about is the peer-to-peer network in Bitcoin. So transactions and blocks get gossiped over this peer-to-peer network. It's the way your node finds out about what the longest blockchain is. It's the way that miners find out about the chain, the current heaviest weight chain, and continue to build on it. I think that that's probably something our internet infrastructure in general is pretty controlled. And there are a lot of ways to think about isolating Bitcoin nodes, taking Bitcoin nodes off the network, isolating miners. So things that have to do with the network layer, I think, are probably, in my mind, the biggest concern right now. It's really hard to answer that question. You know, what does it mean, biggest concern? Most likely to get exploited, maybe. There probably are bugs in Bitcoin right now. I think the complexity of the Bitcoin software is kind of a bummer. It's not really clear what to do with that, but...
I spoke to Brian Bishop about that once and said, you could probably start with starting fresh, taking out all the knowledge you have now and having it completely rewritten.
I would really like to see that happen. I'm really, really curious to see if everyone who is working on Bitcoin right now decided, okay, let's just start over with everything that we've learned, yeah. what would that look like? I think that's a really interesting question.
Bitcoin 2.
Yeah, Bitcoin 2.0. I don't know. I don't know what would, or maybe Bitcoin 1.0 because it's still like 0.0. So I think that's a really interesting question. But yeah, the software has just sort of grown organically over time. It's super complex. And the more complex the software is, the easier it is to introduce bugs. And so things like code review become very important. I know this is something that Corey's really, really worried about and is thinking about. How do we do more testing? Mm-hmm. How do we do things like fuzzing or...
What's fuzzing?
Fuzzing is this idea where, like, if you think about a piece of software as something that takes inputs and then outputs things, mm-hmm. you fuzz the inputs. So you try to put in, like, all possible combinations of inputs to this piece of software, as many as you possibly can. Usually it's infeasible to think about sort of creating them all, like it's impossible, but all combinations, but you try as many as you can. So fuzzing means like, let's just take this piece of software and let's just test the crap out of it. We're going to put in as all these different inputs and see if it might break with inputs we didn't expect. That's the idea.
Right, okay.
So there are software fuzzing techniques. There's all this stuff. So yeah, so I'd say the network layer is probably one of the most things that I'm most concerned about. I think one of the most interesting things though is proof of work itself and how secure proof of work really is. So there's a lot of people who knock proof of work because of the energy usage, right? And to me, that is so backwards that you just look at the raw energy usage and you say, this is too much. It's like, well, hey, how much energy are we using every day to manufacture aluminum? Is that worth it? We've decided it's worth it as a society because we buy aluminum and there's a market for creating aluminum and there, you know, we clear that market. And so same with Bitcoin, kind of, is that we've decided there's a certain value to this. And so we're willing to expend energy that costs this much in order to secure the Bitcoin network. But the question is, how secure is it really? And what is the game theory behind proof of work, the exchanges, and the miners, the exchanges, the users, like all these different people? And I think what we saw with Binance and the hack is just the beginning.
Okay, I'm going to need more than that.
Okay, well, so
you can't just say the beginning.
Yeah, well, so what did we see there is we saw someone who has a lot of money realize that if they wanted to, they could maybe talk to the miners mm-hmm. and offer to pay them a lot and get them to mine on a fork where a transaction that was not advantageous to them was removed, the hack that stole the money from Binance, right?
Which also happened in Bitcoin Cash recently. There was a block reorg.
Yeah, there have been reorgs in Bitcoin Cash, in ETC, in Vertcoin, many different times.
It was called Honest Mining, right?
Honest Mining?
Yeah,
what does that mean?
I think that's what they... So I went onto the subreddit to read about it, and it was referred to as Honest Mining.
Bitcoin Cash's subreddit?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I don't know what that means.
I think that's a way of justifying a reorg.
Okay. Well, you know, we expect miners to be rational, not altruistic, because if we really expected them to be altruistic, then why are we even bothering wasting all this proof of work and this like complicated game? So this idea that they're rational means that, you know, hey, the bigger and more important Bitcoin gets, the more likelihood that something happens where it might make sense to try to bribe the miners. So, you know, will the miners do this? Is it in their long-term interest not to do this? People sort of make these hand-wavy arguments, but we don't really have like the solid math behind, you know, what is the game around this? What is in the interest of the miners or not in the interest of the miners?
This is probably why we need Matt Carello's better hash then, right? Because that will take the power away from the miners.
Yeah, so there are all these like tools to try to make this better. So like one thing is, I don't really know the details of better hash, but things like that, I think, are where mining pools don't just sort of blindly mine on a header that's given to them by the mining pool operator, but instead get some decision-making choice in what they want to mine on. And so this helps with decentralization. So yeah, we need all these things, more of these things.
So you think there's a bigger conversation to be had around proof of work then? You think this is quite risky?
Yes, I think proof of work is pretty risky. It's amazing it's been working in practice for 10 years though. And to be clear, I think proof of work is probably the least risky.
Right, okay.
But I still think it's pretty risky. Okay. So, and I think we have to really understand it better in order to make accurate comparisons to these other consensus protocols that are popping up.
So what would you like to see happen then with this?
I want to see more research on proof of work.
Just research?
Yeah, I want to see more research. I want to see more people evaluating it in more realistic models and figuring out how to do actual comparisons, like apples to apples comparisons to things like proof of stake.
Okay. One of the things I found interesting as well in your presentation was, and quite concerning, was the, I think it was the Zcash bug.
Yeah.
That is a bug that could have been exploited without anyone knowing.
Yeah.
Like, being unable to detect an inflation bug being exploited, I think, is very scary.
Yeah, isn't that scary? That's, like, that terrifies me. Yeah. It's like you have no idea. Like, yeah. Just no clue. I mean, and to be fair, they could implement something like a turnstile where you take everything in the, like, you have some idea of how much money is supposed to be in the shielded pool. And so if someone were to inflate it, you could force everyone to come out of the shielded pool and then, you know, like, cap it at whatever the amount's supposed to be. But that doesn't mean that the people are supposed to get the money, right? And it's just really scary. Like, how do you even know you need to do that? The fact that we're, and this is something where I think a lot of people disagree with me. Like, I find really complex cryptography and new cryptography really scary. Like, it's exciting, but I'm not sure we should be making billions of dollars of value rest on it until we've put it through some more paces.
It's a bit late for that.
Yeah, kind of is late for that. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
We could get to trillions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, things like Bitcoin use very conservative cryptography that we understand really, really well. You know, the newer stuff is a little scary. And it's not just the cryptographic primitives either. It's the fact that you can't see what's happening, right? So even if you... But at least with, I don't know, I have a lot of debates with people about this. Some people say, look, the older the cryptography, the more eyes are looking at it, meaning the safer it is. Some people say the more people who might know how to attack it, the more time people have had with it. I don't know. So this is a hard conversation to have, I think, and I don't know what the answer is. But I think we should be a little bit more, like, you see people creating these new cryptocurrencies and they're like, cutting edge cryptography, I invented this whole new thing. Investors should be running the other way from that. Like, why would you want that? Why would you want this thing that's so completely untested?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think that we could have a complete financial system worth trillions of dollars, which is a decentralized platform and just built on code.
Yeah.
And there could be an unknown bug in there.
Yeah.
That could make somebody a billionaire.
Yeah.
Just a click.
Yeah.
So that's what you think about.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I think about. But I mean, the counter argument to that is like, okay, great, Neha, so what? We're never going to get, like, you're never going to run new code. And I understand that. I just think today, we need to be a little bit more careful.
What else are we not thinking about? What else do you think within the world of Bitcoin are people not paying enough attention to?
I think we're not thinking enough about, this is going to sound a little corny, but I think we're not thinking enough about ethics.
Okay. No, that's important.
Yeah. So the internet started out as this kind of nirvana of open publishing, right? Like, I would run a website, I'd put my information on the internet. It was, you know, anybody could see it, anybody could connect to me. There were all these open protocols. And then out of that developed Facebook, Google, Amazon. And we didn't really see that coming. And now this topic of ethics in artificial intelligence is really big, right? Like, you have these algorithms that are being used to label people in photos, sometimes used for things like law enforcement or used to decide who should get credit. And quite rightly, people are a little worried about, you know, how they operate, who they might be privileging or not privileging. And I think finance is, you know, way more important than both of those things, publishing and the algorithms we use for artificial intelligence and machine learning. So are we even thinking about this? Like, are we even thinking about who gets access to what and what kinds of unintended systems might be being built on top of this stuff, right? Like, the people who worked on the internet in the 80s and 90s also thought they were building this great open system. They did not predict surveillance. They did not they did not predict the advertising, or some of them might have, but they weren't able to stop it. I don't want to build that type of stuff into this technology, and I think we have to be really aware of how things might have gone wrong in the past and think very carefully about how we might prevent it from going wrong in the future.
Well, how could it go wrong? What kind of bad things are you worried that people will do?
I mean, one example is privacy. I think that's the easiest example to understand. You know, let's take Libra, right, by Facebook, all the transactions are public. Like, all the transactions are public. If this actually becomes a thing that, you know, people in the developing world are using, they've just signed away all of their transactional privacy. And it was just like, yeah, sure, everybody can, it's pseudonymous, it's fine. Like, no, it's not fine. All transactions are public. And so...
Are they?
In Libra? Yeah. Yeah.
To all transactions are public. Do they identify who they're from?
No, they're pseudonymous. So similarly to the way Bitcoin and Ethereum works, you know, you're a public key, you can generate a new public key. But what we've seen in practice is that stuff is pretty easily de-anonymized in a lot of cases. And also, it's not clear that, and this is sort of another thing, like the system is very, you have to be pretty technologically savvy to use this technology right now and to understand the risks you're taking when you do things like say, oh, like for example, here's something very simple. I would like to take donations. So I'm going to put a public key up on my website. And by virtue of the fact that I am using the same address over and over again, I have now linked all of those donations to me, right? This is a very simple thing that a lot of people probably don't think about. And thinking about privacy and thinking about how your privacy might be violated is really hard. And so when we move into a system that is much more technical, I think we might be leaving a lot of the population behind who haven't had the chance to sort of think about this stuff. And compare that to something like cash, right? Everybody kind of understands cash. We know how to use cash. We know that if I give you a $20 bill, like no one's looking at me giving you that $20 bill. But when it turns electronic, it becomes a much different story, mm-hmm. and it's much harder to understand. So, you know, this technology by its nature is making a lot of stuff digital that maybe wasn't digital before, and that's a little scary.
So you're not a fan of Libra?
I wouldn't say that necessarily. No. I'm trying to understand it. So I'm trying to understand what's happening with Libra. Yeah.
Okay. So where are you at with your understanding of it?
So, yeah.
I'm, you know what? Sorry, I'm jumping in here, but
yeah.
I'm kind of on the fence with it.
Yeah.
I see good things, I see bad things. I had a conversation with Caitlin Long.
Yeah.
And she was saying this could be great for people in developing countries. You know, gives them access to money. It's an easy way to send money abroad with no fees. You know, it will probably enforce a better discipline from the central banks of these developing countries. So all those kind of things, I thought, oh, it's kind of cool. Plus, naturally, more people will hear about Bitcoin because of it. Again, cool. But at the same time, it's Facebook.
Yeah, so I think that there is a very dystopian vision for cryptocurrencies that we don't necessarily talk about very much, which is something like a government that doesn't have a great history of human rights or of preserving the rights of its citizens creates a digital currency upon which they control most of the access. They require everyone to use it instead of cash, and boom, you've got this like massive surveillance system for every single financial transaction that's happening in the economy of this country. I think that that is a tool. That as a tool is really scary.
Really scary.
Really scary and quite possible. Another dystopian vision is a company creating a means of payment that ends up getting adopted across the world and basically takes what was the government's role, who, you know, at least in a lot of places are elected officials who report, you know, who are accountable to the public who elected them. You know, it takes a responsibility that they had and moves it into the hands of the CEO of the company, which is how do you control the flow of assets inside, you know, in and out of the country? How do you manage interest rates? How do you sort of manage the economy of this country? Becomes something that the elected officials can no longer do effectively.
Hmm.
And that's also kind of scary. So, you know, if it's some CEO in another country who is not accountable to the people of that country, who cannot be removed, you know, or like lose the next election, that's also kind of scary. I don't know what the right answers are. I don't know, but that like terrifies me. It absolutely terrifies me. And we have to think about these things. We have to think about what we're making possible. Like, no technology is all good or all bad. Never, right? There are always positives and negatives, and there are always unintended consequences. And we have to do our best to try to think about this and be thoughtful about it before we release these things into the world.
Zuck's getting super powerful now, isn't he?
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Also, I actually, just on that point where you said about like a country issuing a digital currency and forcing its people to use it, it's actually very useful to have physical money at times as well. And to suddenly put that on people that you can only use digital money, you can only use ours, we can block and censor your transactions, actually becomes really, really scary.
It does, yeah. It does become really scary.
So you just think about all the scary shit.
Sometimes, yeah. Well, you're bringing that up. You asked me about Libra, and that's what I think about when I think about Libra. Yeah, also, I'm kind of struggling myself to fully understand the benefit of a consortium-based permissioned blockchain for anything. So
it's not even a blockchain, though, is it?
Yeah. So, or whatever it is, right? You know, what is the benefit of having multiple organizations as validators? Especially when, like, the set of companies that are, the permissions are very tightly controlled. Like, why not just run this as a why not create a new legal entity that operates under certain restrictions? Just run this as a SQL database. I don't understand why you have to have this sort of like blockchain theater around, you know, everybody's running a node and validating transactions. I don't really see what you get for that when you have the legal system. Yeah. So I'm a bit confused about that right now and still trying to understand. But at the same time, you know, Facebook is a pretty big, successful company and has a lot of smart people there. So, you know, maybe there is something that they're getting from this kind of architecture that I don't quite understand. But that's something that I'm trying to figure out.
Okay. So what are you working on now then?
A few different things. So we're still working on trying to figure out what to do to make cryptocurrency more secure.
Okay.
And we are working on sort of a plan to do more things in the Bitcoin ecosystem in order to improve security. The first step of that was to make it easier to find information about where to report vulnerabilities. And the next few steps will involve things like writing more testing code, getting more people involved, getting more eyes on it, things like that. So that's something that we are working on. And, you know, also just explaining to people the differences in between cryptocurrency and other sort of security realms and getting people to understand how scary it is and what's going on, just explaining that to people and getting more people involved and more eyes looking at things. Another thing that I personally am working on is this question of how to understand proof of work and the security behind proof of work. So that's another topic that we are working on. And we have some ideas where if you think about the ecosystem as a whole, so not just miners, but you know, users and the power that users have to choose between forks and the threat of a fork, how that might help keep miners in line and prevent forking and double spending. So that's another project that we're working on. And then finally, you know, something that I'm spending a bit of time on is really trying to educate people who are really excited about blockchains for voting, particularly political elections, why that might be a bad idea.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that's a terrible idea.
Yeah, well, startups are raising millions of dollars and jurisdictions are trying it out. So it's happening, which is kind of scary.
Okay. And if people are interested in MIT and the Digital Currency Initiative, how do they find out more and who do you want to hear from?
Well, we have a website, dci.mit.edu. Mm-hmm. We have a Twitter account, MITDCI. So hit us up at either of those places. Who are we looking for? If any of what we said resonated with you, I guess, and you're interested in working on cryptocurrency technology, security, scalability, please feel free to get in touch and we'd love to talk to you.
Have you got open roles that you're recruiting for?
It's pretty ad hoc at the moment. So, you know, we create roles for the right people.
Oh, awesome. Well, listen, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks.
So what did you make of that? That was pretty cool, right? I love Neha. She's such a badass. I love everything she's doing at MIT with the Digital Currency Initiative. And she looks at Bitcoin from a different perspective to a lot of the people I speak to. And Tadra's a bit like that, actually, as well. So maybe it's a Boston thing. Maybe it's a DCI thing. I don't know. Boston's a pretty cool place anyway. Neha's opinions, I think, are pretty unbiased, whereas lots of people will argue over whether proof of work is better than proof of stake. It's rare that someone says, well, maybe neither are perfect. I also thought it was pretty cool how future-focused she is when thinking about the ethics of what's being built and whether future application is being taken into account while current solutions are being developed. I just really appreciated the way she thinks about things. And as I said in the intro, you know, when she was talking about the legal risk of disclosing bugs, that was, yeah, something I hadn't thought through. So, yeah, super interesting. Loved doing it. Thanks, Neha. Thanks for having me over at MIT. If you've got any questions about the show, you can get back to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And if you want to support the show, there's loads of things you can do. Firstly, just check out the ads. I know some people don't want to listen to ads, but actually, it's the ads that pay for me to do this. These interviews in person are always better. And with the sponsors, I get to travel around and meet all these great people and do the interviews. So check them out. Check out BlockFi, Acquainting, Kraken, and Dropbit. And also, look, if you don't want the ads, you can become a patron. So head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid for $5 a month. You can get the show ad-free. But if you don't want to use Patreon, you can use crypto. Just drop me an email. I'll give you an address to send to you and add you to the distribution list. And you can also use Lightning, which is cool. You can buy merchandise on the website. You can become a show sponsor. You can leave me a review on iTunes or click on the subscribe button. You can follow me on social media. You can check out my website. You can sign up to my newsletter and you can share the show out with your friends and family. So many things you can do to support the show. Anyone that does anything, a massive thank you from me. I'm in New York at the moment. I'm recording a couple of interviews today before I head out to Chicago. Then I'm off to LA and San Francisco. So I'm going to be recording loads of amazing interviews. Can't wait to get them out for you. Hopefully I'll meet up with some of you while I'm on this trip as well. Okay, any questions, give me a shout. You know my email address now. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com.